I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Dr. L.J. Krumenacker from Idaho State University. We're time traveling back to the age of dinosaurs in Idaho. What ferocious creatures are lurking? Stay tuned to find out more. Peter.
Dinosaurs.
Hey, I wish the zoo had more dinosaurs. Can you work on that?
Someday, I think partnering with the Museum of Natural History here, we might get some dinosaurs at that zoo.
I think we could work on that. You know, but you have birds, and birds are dinosaurs, and
Completely.
So you've already got that checked.
And we have some reptiles as well. We have a desert tortoise, so, you know, we've got some...
You've got it cornered.
We got it cornered.
Well, today on the show, we're going to talk about a time period in Idaho when the world looked a little different. But here roaming in the mountains of Idaho back then, we had some really interesting animals, and LJ is going to tell us a whole lot more about that. But first up, nature news, Peter.
We've got some fun bit of news. There's a recalibration going on this year, Leif.
A recalibration?
A recalibrate carbon 14.
Carbon 14. I always knew it was off by just a little bit.
Just a hair.
Okay.
So plants and animals, when they're living, they all absorb carbon.
That's some carbon today.
That's carbon. Yeah, that's all life-based critters all have carbon.
Go on.
Within that carbon, they have a radioactive isotope called carbon 14.
Excellent.
And when these animals die, they stop bringing in carbon, but since it's carbon 14 is a radioactive isotope, it starts to decay.
That's right.
And it's got a half-life, and that half-life is 5,730 years, approximately. And people can measure how much carbon 14 is in, say, bone.
Sure.
Then they can determine how long it's been dead, or in more positive terms, when it was alive.
Perfect.
But the problem is, when they make these calculations, they have assumed that carbon 14 has stayed consistent in the environment through all these years.
Oh, that the amount of carbon 14 that ancient critters or people have consumed over time, that the amount of C14 they've ingested is the same ratio they would ingest today.
Yes.
Gotcha.
But that's not true. That doesn't hold true.
Aha.
And they have to periodically go through these recalibrations.
Okay.
And historically, since the 60s, when we say historically, they would mainly use tree rings on these really old ancient trees. And, you know, it got them close enough, but it really wasn't completely accurate. And since 1998, they found new ways to recalibrate. And they used data from laminated lakes and marine sediments and cave stalagmites and corals. And instead of using maybe 500 data points, they're going well above 12,000 data points. So they're getting a much more accurate recalibration. And the last recalibration was in 2013. And they realized they had a problem. That calibration was about 500 years off.
Oh, geez.
And so when you think about it, you know, present time, we're in the year 2020. That's one quarter of this present time that they have inaccurate data on. It's important. And you know, especially when you look at the human species, the Homo sapiens versus the Neanderthals, you know, that 500-year time period is actually really pretty important when we look at what happened to the Neanderthals and how they interacted with Homo sapiens.
Interesting. And so, so really, we're talking about an error bar or an amount of certainty that we would have on an age maybe shifting by up to a few hundreds of years.
Yes.
And that could change the kinds of stories that we connect to materials that have ages that are really close to each other.
Right.
In the past. Well, that's really interesting. I bet we're going to see a lot of unfolding changed stories as a result of that new calibration.
Yep. And it's exciting.
And the nature of science, of course, is that we are always changing how we measure and trying to get more data to be more precise in how we are able to tell apart time and tell stories from the past. Well, thanks for bringing that one into us. Carbon 14. Make sure to eat your carbon 14 today so that future generations can measure you.
Future scientists need you to eat carbon 14.
That's good. Well, you know, today we're going to be talking about things that are much, much, much older than that. We don't even use carbon 14 back this far to look at ancient dinosaurs from millions and millions of years ago. Our trivia question deals with the age of the dinosaurs. How many years ago did the very first dinosaurs appear in the fossil record? Millions and years ago. How many millions of years ago is the question? We're going to get to that answer and a whole lot more about dinos in Idaho right after this break.
Try streaming our signal at KISU.org or simply tell your Amazon or Google smart speaker to play KISU. Remember, even when our FM signal is out, KISU continues streaming live online.
Hey, we're back from the break. I want to welcome Dr. L.J. Krumenacker. He's a research associate at Idaho State University and the Idaho Museum of Natural History. So thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Thanks for the invite.
Well, so you're a paleontologist. You work on vertebrate animals primarily. Those are animals with backbones. So tell us about how you got into paleontology in the first place.
Oh, well, there's a very specific memory that comes to mind. So I was a Boy Scout on a camping trip in the mountains east of Blackfoot, if anyone's been up to Wolverine Canyon. I was probably about 8 years old, and we were camping at this site, and I walked up to a rock, and it was covered with these weird shapes that turned out to be fossils. And ever since then, I've just had an interest in fossils, and of course, kids like dinosaurs. I just never grew up and said, well, dinosaurs, they're fossils. Let's see if I can make a career out of this.
Right on. And what were they that you actually found out there?
They were little sea animals called bryozoa. So they'd live in oceans and they'd live in colonies and filter food out of the water. They look like little nets.
That's right. I tell people they look like Chex Mix.
Yes.
If you've ever eaten that. they're very simple looking fossils, well, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
And how did you make the turn to dinosaurs? Were you already interested in them?
I was interested in dinosaurs as time went along, and in high school I decided I wanted to see if I could find dinosaurs, and I'd started doing a little research. I said, okay, from what I could see, what was written at the time, there weren't really any found in Idaho other than a few bits and pieces. So I made a connection. I wrote a letter to who would be my future undergrad advisor, Dr. Bill Ackerson, asked him about dinosaurs here in Idaho, and he gave me some pointers, mentioned that a few had been found. And as soon as I started as an undergrad here, I managed to get involved with research and start looking on dinosaurs dinosaurs from Idaho on my own, and it just went downhill from there. So
what was the first dinosaur that you found?
First, I was just finding little bone scraps the size of my thumb where I don't know what they were. The first one that we found that we could identify in those bone scraps probably belonged to is a small plant-eating and herbivorous dinosaur called Erictodromius.
Erictodromius. And we'll talk a little bit more about that animal. It's a very special one for Idaho in a moment. How does one go about finding dinosaurs?
Finding dinosaurs, it's basically like a scavenger hunt. First, you want to be in an area where you have rocks of the right age, from the age of dinosaurs, and you want to be in an area where you have rocks of the right type, sedimentary rocks made out of mud, sand, or silt. Then basically, you're just walking around looking at the rocks, kind of nose to the ground, eyes to the ground, looking for little pieces of bone. Easy way to do this is to kind of go through dry washes or lower elevation spots. And when you find the bone, you'll start to try and trace it uphill to see where it's coming out of. And if you're lucky, you can find that bone coming out of a certain spot of the hill. You just follow it up and try and find the source poking out.
It sounds like there's a bit of preparation that goes into finding dinosaurs, because you said you need to find rocks of the right age, and you need to find rocks of the right type, and then, of course, then you're actually boots on the ground hunting around for them. Tell us a little bit about that preparation that goes into figuring out where to go.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're going to look at geologic maps. It'll tell you that information about the rocks and the rock age and the rock type. You also want to make sure you have permission of the landowner. So here in the U.S., if it's public land, you have to have a permit to collect any fossils that come from animals with bones, vertebrate fossils. Typically, I work with Caribou Targhee National Forest. They've always been great, helping me get permits to do that. So you get your permission. You'll get your maps to figure out where to go. Then you're going to need your basic collecting supplies, things to preserve the bones and to safeguard them. Usually anything like this, you're not going to go out and automatically collect a dinosaur. You're going to go out, you're going to find it, if you're lucky. Then you're going to have to look at the extent, how much work it's going to take to collect it. Then you're going to have to plan for the next month or the next year, whenever you can get back out there, to have a whole team of people to come out and help you collect the animal. The more people you have for anything like that, usually the better, because it can be backbreaking work, even for little dinosaurs.
Of course, I feel I should mention, as a museum guy, that this public fossils that are collected on public land, ultimately, as part of the deal for getting permission to collect them, they end up in public museums like the Idaho Museum of Natural History, so that they're available to the public in a museum setting where they're safeguarded for perpetuity, forever.
Yeah.
So you're in the field, you're hiking around. This sounds like fun.
Oh, yeah. That's what gets me... got me attracted to it. It's a thrill of discovery, and you're outside, and you're basically playing outside. You're hiking. I like to hike anyway, and you're finding cool things, making discoveries, coming up with more questions when you make these discoveries, and it's just a vicious cycle that way.
So as you're exposing the bones, the fossils that you find, you're not using dynamite. You're not using sledgehammers.
Not in this century.
You know, so when we talk about backbreaking work, it's fine backbreaking work. You're not necessarily going to be a bulldozer.
No. It's, you got to have patience. I mean, if you like sitting in one spot on the ground on your knees for a few hours using a toothbrush, this is your thing. But actually, that's a lot cooler than it sounds. You're going to have to do that a lot to uncover the bone. Some of the hardest thing is when you have, say, a 300-500 pound jacket of rock, once you've got the fossil collected and coated with a protective plaster cap, and then you have to haul it a half mile uphill to your waiting vehicle. That's the more painful part. That's what students are for, no offense.
Well, we've all been students at one point, doing exactly that kind of work probably. Earlier, you had said something about the idea back when you were starting out that folks hadn't found dinosaurs, or many dinosaurs certainly, in the state of Idaho. We live in a part of the world, certainly out west, where, you know, states like Utah and Montana and Wyoming are really famous for the dinosaurs that have come out of the ground. We're right next to them. So what's the deal with Idaho and dinosaurs?
Hi, so your fossil-rich states around Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, they have one thing in their favor out in their dinosaur beds, and that is the climate. It's much drier, and plants don't cover up nearly as much of the dinosaur-bearing rocks there. Here in Idaho, we have the opposite problem. We have plants covering up all of our dinosaur-bearing rock. There's actually a lot of it in the easternmost part of the state, but 99.9% is covered by sagebrush, grass, and trees. So really, there's another step for looking for dinosaurs in Idaho. Before you go out and look for the dinosaurs, you have to go out and look for the rocks that you can actually see that aren't covered up by plants.
Yes, and having walked much of that eastern part of Idaho, it's one of the beautiful things about being in Idaho is that nature loves being here, and we've got lots of plants and animals. But when we're looking for fossils and looking for rocks that contain those fossils, plants really get in the way.
Yeah, they cover up the rock, and it's, you know, it's, I always have this silly thing as I'm walking, you know, to this, you know, 200 square meter outcrop, saying, I wonder how many dinosaurs I'm passing over now as I'm walking through a half mile of sagebrush.
And sagebrush, as it turns out, love dinosaur bones. They, like, grow into them in places that I've worked down further south where there aren't so many. They seem to favor growing right in the middle of a dinosaur skeleton.
Oh, they do. They go for the phosphate, I think.
Maybe. There's nutrients there to be had. So why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the dinos that did live here?
Okay. So the most common dinosaur that we know of from Idaho so far is called Erictodromius cubicularis. So I just like to call it Ericto. It's easier. This animal, so imagine a little biped, two-legged animal, about 4 foot tall, with a 7 foot tail and a 4 foot body, two little arms, little beak on his head, on a moderate-sized neck, little typical plant-eating dinosaur. What's interesting about these animals is they're small, their bones are fairly fragile, they're actually hollow. In most places in Utah, Montana, Wyoming, dinosaurs that are small are super rare because their bones are small. They break easy. What are common dinosaurs, the big ones that have giant bones that take a long time to rot. Here in Idaho, we've got lots of these small dinosaurs that should be rare. But this little Recto is just your stereotypical little plant eater for the most part.
Where does it live? I mean, how did it live?
How did it live? So this is the thing that got people's attention with the Recto. So dinosaurs, again, you think the big, sexy meat-eating dinosaurs, they get a lot of attention. What's cool about a Recto, it got a lot of attention because my PhD advisor discovered the first burrow of a dinosaur in southwest Montana, and it turned out to be a Recto. This animal in this holotype burrow in southwesternmost Montana, they found the adult skeleton with two juvenile teenage dinosaurs all huddled in the bottom in a living chamber in this burrow. And this was the first time that we have evidence for a burrowing dinosaur, and it's great evidence for parental care and social interactions.
I have to ask this question, and you can make up the answer. I'm not too worried about it. You said they had hollow bones.
Mm-hmm.
Hollow bones are found in modern-day birds, so they can fly. They're light, but that doesn't necessarily make them strong. And when you look at a burrowing animal, especially like a mammal, they've got these massive front legs and heavy-duty solid bones because it's hard work. Why would you think these guys have hollow bones?
That's a good question. And to be honest, I can't give you a specific answer. It seems to be possibly an ancestral trait in these more primitive, more basal dinosaurs. A lot of them have these small hollow bones. Now, when I say hollow, they're not like bird hollow, not like paper thin. The bones themselves might be a centimeter thick for the outer bone wall, but they still have a large medullary cavity, kind of empty cavity in the bone there. Could be to help them be a little bit lighter for running faster. While talking about massive bones helping animals dig, so there was a colleague of mine, Jamie Fearon, that was a master's student at Montana State. She did a study looking at the bones of Rictodromius, basically the shoulder bones, and comparing them to shoulder bones of other dinosaurs to see if this guy was statistically a little beefier to support the burrowing idea. And it actually turns out that he was. Additional evidence that's found in the skeleton that shows this guy's burrowed is they have fused snout. Usually these dinosaurs have a left snout and a right snout, left maxilla, right maxilla, or sorry, premaxilla. These premaxilla are fused in this animal, which is rare, which we interpret as evidence that this guy would kind of use his nose to push dirt around to help him dig. He has very large and curved shoulder blades compared to other dinosaurs that are for the muscle attachments, for scratch digging with his forelimbs, and his legs, the femur, the thigh bones. The top of them have a funny angle that, again, we interpret as it would fit into the hip socket and help him brace his legs and hold place while he scratch digs with his beefy arms and uses his strengthened beak to help as well.
Very interesting. And Recto, Rictodromius, is that the most common dinosaur that we find in the fossil record here in Idaho?
It is. It is in this packet of rocks called the Wayan Formation. It is, if you're counting skeletal elements and not an eggshell that's common, a Recto is probably 90% of what you find. It is abnormally common for what you would think is a normal dinosaur assemblage.
And so you mentioned eggs. So we get eggs here. Tell us about the dinosaur eggs that are found.
Yeah, so we have eggs from what I call a killer chicken. So imagine a chicken that's about 15 feet tall with clawed fingers that's going to eat you and your children. That is this animal. What's weird, though, is we have not found a single bone of this animal. So how the heck do we know that we have it? It goes back to this eggshell, but we have found eggs that are, off the top of my head, about 15 inches long from this animal. The eggshell is super common in these rocks. If you were to go out with me and do dinosaur hunting, you'd almost be guaranteed with enough time, the first thing you would find is some eggshell, then maybe some Recto bits. The whole way that we know that this egg comes from this Oviraptor source, similar to Gigantoraptor, is in China, in rocks of the same age, we have the same eggs, and in these eggs, we have found the baby Oviraptor source.
Very interesting. And so waiting perhaps in the ground to be found here in Idaho are baby Oviraptors associated with those eggs.
And they'd be cute.
They would be cute.
I'm just thinking of the chicken coop.
Yeah.
15-foot bigger coop. Tall yeah. chicken coop, yeah.
With those barbed wire, hot wire, it'd be like the grizzly bear exhibit.
Those are some big eggs. And so we get lots of eggshell from this particular animal or mm-hmm. this type of egg, and we get Erictodromius, the burrowing dinosaur. Mm-hmm. So does that suggest that the eggs were buried as well?
So this goes back to our question, or at least a question that I always had is, why the heck is this sort of dinosaur that's usually rare so common here in Idaho? So as part of my PhD thesis, and actually the first part I finally got published last year, was a paper talking about reasons I think we have this sort of dinosaur assemblage here in Idaho, these burrowing dinosaurs and these eggs. And it goes back to, I hypothesized, and we've got pretty good evidence for, that during this time when these animals lived in Idaho, it was hard to get buried if you died on the ground surface. But if you're basically digging your own grave, like Erictodromius, or if you would possibly be burying your eggs, you're basically halfway there to making a fossil of those eggs or those bones. And this is supported by the porosity of the eggshell, which suggests that these eggs were buried by sediment or vegetation.
Very interesting. And so we've got those two animals that we have good evidence for. What else do we find in those rocks?
Oh, it's just a tease. Idaho is a tease for this dinosaur stuff. But there's one spot called the Robison Bone Bed. I named after a mentor of mine that actually showed me this site. So this was, oh goodness, maybe 15 years ago. He showed me this little tiny outcrop of a really coarse grain conglomerate poking out of a hill, and I noticed there's a little bit of bone in it, and the rock's too hard to get anything out. About 10 years later, I was out there just checking the site out again, and I noticed that there were construction stakes all along that hillside. So this was out with Caribou Targhee National Forest on their lands, and I talked to them, and it turned out they were going to mine that hill to make a road fill, which concerned me. In the process of talking to them, they said, hey, well, when we do this, you can come out and look at the rocks. We'll save as much as we can for you. And I started doing that, and in these rocks, we found evidence for all these animals we didn't know about before. We have teeth from what is probably, and it's hard to say because it's just teeth, Tyrannosauroid, basically T-Rex's great-great-great-great-great-grandpa sort of situation. We have very small teeth from another site that represent a Tyrannosauroid the size of a Great Dane. I mean, this tooth is about the size of your pinky nail. We have armored dinosaurs known from a partial skeleton that we have here at the museum that I'm slowly getting prepared and worked on. This is the only good partial skeleton of a non-Erictodromus dino we have here in Idaho. We have raptors, you know, the raptors from Jurassic Park, a bunch of different sizes. I found a raptor tooth that's maybe 2 millimeters long. I'm amazed I saw it sitting there in the rock. So it's like crow size. Two raptors that might have a tooth about half an inch long. So a big diversity of carnivorous dinosaurs. We have that armored dinosaur known from a skeleton and bits and pieces. We have teeth from larger plant-eating dinosaurs called iguanodonts or hadrosauroids. We have little fur balls, mammals. I was able to name one after my advisor again, Bill Ackerston, last year, Cimlodon Ackerstoni. So we have this diverse community of mammals, dinosaurs, and I almost forgot, crocodiles and turtles and these dinosaurs. So a good diverse community that's just barely hinted at.
That's wonderful. And that's all sitting out in the hills in eastern Idaho. And so I'm trying to imagine this world. What's the time period that group is? You mentioned the great-great-great-grandfather of T-Rex, and mm-hmm. T-Rex was one of the last of the big dinosaurs before the extinction event 66 million years ago. How old is this stuff here in Idaho?
This stuff is about 95 to 100 million years old. So earliest part of the late Cretaceous, about 30 million years before T-Rex. Okay. It's actually really important because this is one of the few places in North America where we have a window into this specific time in the age of dinosaurs. It's really rare, and it makes the assemblage of animals even more important.
That's wonderful, and it's there for us to go find if we have to get through all those challenges of finding the right rocks and getting through the vegetation and so forth.
And it also sounds like once you find them, depending on the rock, it's kind of hard to bring those fossils to light. It's not like it's easy.
No, it takes a lot of work, especially the stuff from the bone bed. That's the hardest rock I've ever worked on to get, say, a vertebra the size of your thumb out of there. If it's totally encased in that rock, you might be looking at 30 hours of thumb painful work.
So in all of your time going out searching for fossils of all sorts of types, this is one project that you've been working on certainly. What's your favorite fossil find? What was the one that kind of blew your mind?
Oh, so probably one I named after my daughter. I just called Elise's dinosaur. Of course, it's an Erectodromius. The reason I was fond of this one, though, is I found it just, if I remember right, just after she was born, so I named it after her. And it was articulated, meaning all the bones are in place. Unfortunately, the head had poked out of the hill first, so it's long gone. But you have a neck connected to a back, connected to a butt, connected to a legs, with the arm still in place, and then most of the tail's missing. But it's just a beautiful specimen. It looks like the poor thing sat down out on the highway and someone ran over it and pancaked it. So,
Fred Flintstone.
Yeah, poor thing. But it's awful cute.
It's awful cute. That's great. What else are you working on in the paleontology of the state?
Oh, so I've got an interest basically in anything dinosaur age or older. The museum has a great holding of mammals, and I just want to see stuff before that and see what we can learn about. I'm working on things all over the map. So you go back to the beginning of complex life on the planet, the first things with arms and legs and limbs and complex digestive tracts. It's called the Cambrian Explosion, about 540 million years ago off the top of my head. I'm working on Cambrian Explosion fossils we have here in Idaho from a rock called the Spent Shale with some colleagues, Dr. Ree Levine and Julian Kimmig. We're looking at what fossils are preserved and why, and just redescribing them, because apparently we have a lot of undescribed species from these rocks. I'm interested in the Permian-Triassic extinction, so the largest extinction in the history of the planet, about 252 million years ago, wiped out roughly 90% of every living thing. I found, very fortuitously, a nice fossil site near Bear Lake that documents recovery from that extinction and shows a very diverse ecosystem much sooner than scientists had anticipated, and I've been working with a bunch of very knowledgeable colleagues describing that post-extinction recovery. Really, I think, Idaho's got a lot left to offer, and these are just hints of that.
It's sort of one of those best-kept secrets in our industry of states that haven't been really thoroughly investigated for their fossils, except we obviously do have really good collections on the age of mammals,
which
is the last 65 million years, but you go older than that. Pretty much half of the terrain in Idaho is fossil-bearing, and it's really fantastic stuff. Can you help us with the trivia question that we started the day off with, which deals with the age of fossils? When does the age of dinosaur fossils begin?
So the age of dinosaurs begins about 230 million years ago in the middle to early late Triassic.
230 million years ago.
And when did you say the age of mammals started, Leif?
Age of mammals is 65 million-ish years ago. So there's a lot of time that's recorded out there. And those fossils record all the life that's occurred on our planet's surface over that time. It's pretty impressive.
We really have to say a big thank you to Dr. L.J. Krumenacher today. To learn more about his research, please visit ljkrumenacher.weebly.com. And if you would like to spell that, that is ljkrumenacker.weebly.com.
Good job.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Happy to share.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at KISU.org or send email to NOIDKISU@ISU.edu.